You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is John Edgar Wideman, the author most recently of Father Along from Pantheon Books. It's a meditation on fathers and sons, race, and society. He's the author as well of All Stories Are True, Philadelphia Fire, Fever, Reuben, Brothers and Keepers, Sent for You Yesterday, Hiding Place, Damballa, The Lynchers, Hurry Home and A Glance Away. Well, let's begin. What does the title refer to?
Well, it's actually, I memorialized a mishearing. When I was a kid, one of my favorite gospel songs was Father Along, F-A-R-T-H-E-R, new word, A-L-O-N-G, Farther Along. But of course, I heard that as Father Along, one word with Father being the important word, the operative word. And when I heard that song, it made me think of God the Father, my natural father. It was a word that made me feel how large the world was, how small I was as a child, and how there were lots of presences in that world that I did not understand. Also, the song was one that I heard my father sing often in the house. My favorite version of the song was Sam Cooke singing Father Along. But my father was right up there with it. He had a beautiful voice, and he sang all the time, not only that gospel song, but all kinds of things around the house. So the word combines a feeling of transcendence, a feeling of a child's smallness, the love of my father, the love of music, and lots of questions that a young kid has about where he belongs and who's out there in control of this mysterious world.
The book is mysterious in a certain way. It begins with a meditation on race, and when we finish that preface, we turn the page and we discover a very specific incident: the difficulty of visiting Pittsburgh, where your parents lived, and being at the mother's house, unable to see the father because they've been separated for years and have difficulty being in each other's presence. And one immediately senses that the small incident is being used to stand for something much larger. Could you speak about the general and the personal in this book?
My father was available to me physically very little in my childhood because he just simply wasn't around the house. He held two or three what we called pizza jobs in order to make do where one good job would have made would have supported us. So it meant that I didn't see him. He wasn't around. He was absent. And then at about the same time I went away to school, my mother and father had personal problems, and it meant that my father and she were separated. So he wasn't around at that stage of my life either. All this meant that it didn't mean that we were estranged, my father and myself, but it meant that he was invisible. He was absent. And the love that I felt for him and the love I felt that he directed towards me, I had to maintain those things, hold them in my imagination. I had to create it. I had to construct it without his physical presence.
But you say that the marginalization of the father stands for the whole issue of race, and I wondered if you could say what you mean.
As I examined my relationship with my father, I didn't mean to try to make a neat metaphor and use that as a way of directing the reader's attention to ways in which African Americans are marginalized in this society. But I think almost inevitably, almost without my even consciously thinking about it, the language of exclusion, the paradigm of exclusion, began to direct the pen, began to direct my thinking. Because after all, here was a man with whom I was connected by blood and time and experience, but it was to my, it became to my benefit to pretend that none of those connections existed, because in because his presence and his personality were a kind of inconvenience. And so I saw myself treating him the way I had been treated and the way African-American people had been treated over time.
Well, you mentioned in the second chapter that almost every relationship with the father, rejecting him, essentially emotionally lynching him, embracing him, stands for a movement of racial politics.
Yes, because for me, there's a kind of bedrock of learned attitudes and conditioned responses that that characterize this culture and probably other cultures as well. And it's a very, very deep and to some extent metaphysical method of handling the other. What frightens us, what appeals to us, that attraction and repulsion. There are probably psychic mechanisms, which nobody can name, certainly not me, that create a paradigm or archetypes that control our handling of the other. And what was fascinating to me as I wrote is that I reproduce these attitudes. I reproduce this this construction of the other in my attitude towards my father. And that became, as I foregrounded that in the writing, I was in fact researching and analyzing a general cultural response.
Well, you mentioned that Richard Wright's relation to his father, for instance, becomes in a way the relationship of writers after Richard Wright to Wright himself, that the father, the literary father, needs to be rejected or overthrown as well. Is there a literary father in your own work whose influence you've been wrestling with?
Well, I think it's a whole passel or a whole posse of literary fathers, and beginning with T.S. Eliot. But I would insist on the generality rather than the individual writer, because somebody like Eliot still informs and is very, very important when I think about influences in my work. I have not abjured him. I have not cut myself away from his influence. But the whole notion that in English literature or the received literature that is taught in colleges and high schools, the idea that that covers the territory, that those famous authors who appear in the anthologies and the ones who I were taught, the idea that in order to be a writer, you somehow have to fall in line and imitate and reproduce what they produced. That is the father I've wrestled with. I think that is the collective psyche or consciousness that I've very consciously worked away from.
When you talk about Akebe in the opening of his novel Things Fall Apart as telling father legends or father myths, is that an alternative to the European tradition or just another father to wrestle with?
Well, Akebe is an interesting writer because he set out to write a novel about his people and Igbo culture. And his notion of novel was a fairly traditional one. But because he's a genius, he transformed it. And with both the infusion of cultural material from Africa, which wouldn't have been that much of a breakthrough, just to funnel in new wine in that old bottle of form. But it was his sensibility, his switching of perspective, and putting an African sensibility at the center of the novel is what is most striking, as well as using the cultural items and the language and the spiritual perspective of Igbo culture. So I think he represents a writer who was very important to me because he legitimized a different sort of content, but was smart enough and good enough so that when he used this different content, it began to affect the form and enlarge the form.
I want to bring up something that happened to me in college when we discovered the writing of Amos Tutwola. I had been in a school where John Barth was the writing teacher, and to discover this extraordinary storyteller from Africa, Tutwola, was a real event. You know, it was Barth who brought the book in, mm-hmm. and he was sort of doing work discovering other of the books beyond the Palm Wine Drinkard, which had been the first published in America. And then one day he came in very disappointed and told us that this style, this individual style of Tutwola's, was not in fact a literary style, but simply the way Tutwola spoke, and that these were transcriptions. And it was as if somehow or other a style that is forged, like Joyce's, was inherently preferable to a style that was natural, a transcription, a vision of the world. And this has been, I think, the dichotomy, in a sense, between the European inheritance of literature and an oral inheritance, the sense that stories are not simply in how they are written, but as well in how they are told. Do you have any feelings about that?
Well, that's an interesting story. It's almost like saying, well, I'm going to take down all my Velázquez paintings because somebody figured out that guy simply had an astigmatism. And that's why those people look the way they do, or get rid of Giacometti's people because somebody figured out some biological trait that Giacometti had that, in fact, the world looked, everybody looked skinny to him. So that I wonder about that. And I'm very suspicious of that reaction and sort of disappointed by it because Barth was doing everybody a great favor. And I think you could make parallels between some things that he consciously figured out that he wanted to do in his books and what Tutwola was doing. And rather than discarding a whole body of work because it seems natural, I think one should ask the question, well, what does natural mean? Well, Tutwola's work represents a historical tradition and conventions that have been worked upon and fashioned and articulated and made more precise over time in the same sense that Mr. Barth or Mr. Joyce or Virginia Woolf sat down at a table and worked through various options for a literate tradition.
I'm speaking to John Edgar Wideman on the occasion of the publication of his book-length essay, Meditation, Farther Along, published by Pantheon. Well, it brings up the whole issue of what literary society makes of what it decides to call naive. And even to suggest that an oral literature, because oral, is therefore necessarily naive, seems to me to be the kind of marginalization that you're talking about. In other words, marginalizing the other because it is unknown. For someone like Barth, who I'm sure came to know much more, this is just, you know, a random example, but to assume that an oral tradition is therefore a naive tradition, that it doesn't have its own sophistications, that there isn't a whole wealth of alternative meaning in a more casual, less written art, seems to me a refusal to understand a culture.
Well, I think somebody would have to be kind of deaf and dumb to reach that conclusion. Also just not informed about the way oral cultures work. After all, the Iliad and the Odyssey are products of oral literature, and everybody wants to jump in line to claim the Greeks as the father of their literature. At least all European cultures do. For me, the models of eloquence that were most important, I'm very clear about this now, were the women in my family. I was lucky enough to grow up in a household of women. Not only did they pamper me and take care of me and make me feel I was the center of the world, but they talked all the time to one another. And listening in that context, I think for openers, I learned to listen in that context because they weren't addressing things to me. And the speech was coded, in a sense, so that I wouldn't understand everything because they were talking about their boyfriends and talking about my uncles and my father and et cetera, et cetera. So they didn't want me to understand too much, but they weren't going to shut up either. So already what I was observing and hearing was a very flexible and fluid kind of vernacular that could assume a register that would exclude Mr. Big Ears, me, who wasn't supposed to understand everything. And the people who were using that vernacular could make that kind of flexible switch. And if you've lived around talkers in an oral culture, and I think it's fair enough to say that I did, growing up in Homewood, the barbershop, the women at home, the preacher on Sunday, the preacher on the radio, the music, all of that. And when I got just a little bit older, a teenager, the kind of talk fest competitions that are involved in the dozens and signifying those male rituals of talk, which made our group what it was and gave people personality and status. If you've lived in an oral culture, you realize first off, I mean very quickly, that there are good talkers and bad talkers and a mile between. And some are very good talkers indeed. And the joy that the very best talkers bring is a kind of ecstasy.
Now, you suggest in this book that the very notion of difference is the father or mother of racial thinking, that to begin to make distinctions begins the idea not only of something different but of something better than another thing, of something other than, inferior to, superior to. And so I wondered, as the book goes along, the book begins with stories of fathers, but by its last chapter, time is conflated in an opening legendary paragraph, and suddenly the book gives way to stories of sons, mm-hmm. stories that you tell of your son. I wondered what the difference between father stories and son stories are for you.
I imagine the book as a kind of a great arc. Part of the effort was to return to South Carolina, this little town called Promised Land, where my grandfather was born and his father on back. I wanted to go with my own father and investigate that place and see if we could recover the names of Widemans that had been lost and root ourselves in that region. That was one direction I wanted the book to move. But the whole point of this investigation was to speak to my sons, to preserve for them and to create for them a sense of belongingness, a sense of authority, demonstrate to them in a very concrete way how much a claim they had to this land and to their identity. So inevitably, the arc had to lead to sons. But I think what to answer your question more directly, there is a circle and a flow. There is no difference between the stories of the fathers and the sons. They feed from one another and they go back to one another and they depend on one another. And in fact, the racial crime that might be one of the most horrific and horrendous is that this cycle of communication, which allows fathers to become sons and sons to become fathers, has been interrupted, has been mediated by voices that are antagonistic, hostile to that process in the African American, among African American men.
You say that all paternity is questionable, that the rhyme mother's baby, father's maybe becomes inevitable for a black man in American culture. Can you explain that?
Well, it has to do with this mediation I was just trying to discuss. I mean, when you ask the question, where do we come from? I think the question you're really asking is, do you belong here? What right do you have to be here? And that's a vexed question for African American people. The answer to that question means that, or trying to answer that question, opens up the past of slavery and oppression and all the issues of division and whether or not black people are in fact equal to Europeans or Asians, et cetera, et cetera. So asking that question means that paternity is being questioned. In fact, in a way, somebody's playing the dozens with us. We're being sort of undressed in public when that question is asked, and it's a literal question. I have blood of Europe and Africa in me. Why is that the case? What does that mean? And then the social pathology that has been enforced on the black community by oppression means that, in fact, many kids don't know who their fathers are. Or if they know their names, they don't know where they are. Or if they know their names and know where they are, they have no visceral relationship. And so that, in that sense, it's a very real and trying question. But I think it also goes back to the a larger issue or a more encompassing issue, and that is Americans. For all Americans, the notion of who's your father, where do you come from, is problematic. And we've been struggling with that. And maybe one of the most basic themes in American literature and art and culture is, are we legitimate? Have we made an impress upon this land? Does American really mean something other than the power to make a whole lot of money and get big muscles and push other people around? Are we more than our material or technological culture? And if we are, what is it? Do we find our roots in England? Why the obsession with English culture? Why do we learn the English classics to the exclusion of the other literatures of the world? There's some real big questions there.
One of the central images in Father Along, at least for me, was the image of the jailhouse. When you go and pick your father up at the old age housing, yes, that he lives in, you say it reminds you of the structures of prisons. And you mention later that your father was unable to visit your brother in prison, to bring himself to make that visit, and your own visits to different jails, as well as counterpointed by visits to the home place, seemed to structure the book. I wondered if you could talk about prison and paternity, because to many Americans right now, paternal structures in themselves are read to be imprisoning.
Well, there's almost nothing I can add except to, I mean, you've cut into the sort of symbolic structure of the book, and all I can say is amen. I'm glad you're making that kind of reading, and certainly it connects with what I was trying to do. But unfortunately for me in my particular life, jails and prisons are not metaphors. They are actual, factual barricades and walls that I have to deal with. And it became incredible to me as I wrote this book how many times I literally crashed into those walls. But if you think of America's relationship to the Africans who were brought here beginning in the 16th century, if you think about that, it's quite clear that one reason we were brought here is to simply be used and then be discarded. And so one of the primary questions of the culture is, how do we keep these folks, these Africans, how do we control them? How do we use them without allowing them to break out of the very utilitarian and from our point of view, self-serving purpose that we brought them here for in the first place? How do we keep them in the box? How do we keep them on the plantation? How do we keep them on the farm? How do we keep them in the inner city ghetto? That's the perpetual problem. And so all sorts of metaphysical and material remedies or solutions to that problem have arised. And using that perspective, that lens, one can make a whole analysis or picture or rendering of American history.
A final question. This book, which is very much about barriers, seems within itself to break down barriers. And listeners know that basically on Bookworm, I talk to novelists or poets. This, you're primarily known, of course, as a novelist and short story writer. This book involves essay styles, bits of sociology, meditation, italicized projected legends, father stories and son stories. And I wondered if there is, what, a literary strategy in the breaking of forms similar to the breaking of barriers.
If there is anything consistent in the body of my work, I think it is that impulse to yoke together those things which other people have sundered. Not only have they sundered, but then set up a set of rules that say you can't yoke them together, or you shouldn't, or it's best not to. And not only has that been a dimension of my literary life, but that's been a dimension of my personal life.
I've been speaking to John Edgar Wideman on the occasion of the publication of Father Along, a meditation on fathers and sons, race and society, published recently by Pantheon. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Pop time.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.